Is There Anybody Out There? A short story written and performed by Darryl Sloan, author of the novels Ulterior and Kion. Visit my website at www.midnightpictures.co.uk. This podcast was created in August 2006. The gentle lapping of the waves against the rocks, the hypnotic clicking of the crickets, and the occasional croak of a frog. These were the sounds of nighttime guard duty, so pleasant they could put you to sleep. But not tonight. Tonight there was a high-pitched whining noise added to the ambience. William Dalton stuck his index finger into his ear canal and wiggled it vigorously. When he took the digit out, it was dry and clean, yet the irritating noise persisted. Maybe I've got tinnitus, he thought, although what he had been doing to cause a permanent ringing in his eardrum was a mystery. Loud music through headphones could do it, but the last time he'd had that particular luxury was 14 years ago, before batteries became too valuable to waste on entertainment. The ringing was so faint it was almost inaudible. If he'd been indoors talking with the others, he wouldn't even have noticed it. But because he was out here alone at the water's edge, he detected it the moment it started, just 2 minutes ago. You're such a hypochondriac. Give your head a good shake and you'll be fine. Dalton slouched in the chair, put his feet up on a rock, and rested the shotgun across his knees. He looked at his watch and yawned. 3 a.m. Another 2 hours of this pointless guard duty ahead. He was supposed to patrol the circumference of the island, all 800 meters of it, every hour on the hour. But this time he was going to take a nap instead, or at least try. If one of the walkers made it across the water to the island tonight, Dalton would surely be the first to die. He accepted this, but he figured he could still fulfill his duty by sounding the alarm with his screams while the creature ate his face off. He also knew it was never going to happen. Walkers, despite their scrambled brains, had enough awareness to know that they couldn't walk on water. And they certainly didn't have the dexterity or buoyancy for swimming. Evans, the boss, had the crazy idea that one of them might manage to wade along the bottom of the lake and end up on the island. Never mind that this had never happened once in the whole 14 years since the community was formed. Shore patrol, as folks called it, was nothing more than a precautionary joke. Dalton sighed, wondering if this ear problem was going to prevent him sleeping. Unless, of course, the sound wasn't inside his head at all. He hadn't considered that. He cupped his hands over both ears. The sound ceased. He uncovered his ears, and the ringing noise returned. Dalton's heart quickened. This was impossible. His mind scrabbled for a rational explanation. The house. It's coming from the house, that's all. Somebody just left an electrical appliance turned on. Except that explanation didn't fit. All the doors and windows were shut, preventing any noise from escaping. And besides, Evans was very particular about wasting precious energy. Just to make sure, Dalton got to his feet and ran across the vegetable garden. Kate would be angry at him for that later, no doubt. Up the path and into the house. No sooner had he closed the door behind him than the ringing noise stopped. He opened the door again, and the tone returned. He could contain himself no longer. Hey, he called up the stairs. Everybody get up! 10 minutes later, the whole community was standing by the water's edge in their pajamas. 4 men, 2 women, and 3 youngsters. Everyone kept quiet, staring across the lake. The darkness of the water was broken by a line of glittering light, the moon's reflection, which led from the water's edge across Loch Ness to the dim outline of rooftops 3 kilometres away. No lights shone on those streets. What Dalton and the others were hearing was no natural sound, nothing that any animal or the wind could emit. This was man-made. Little Sarah Harris, 6 years old, rubbed the sleep from her eyes and looked around at the adults, wondering why they were so mesmerised. "What is it, Daddy?" she asked. "It's a siren, sweetheart," Charlie Harris said. "What's a siren?" It means there's other people alive out there. Oh, Sarah said and yawned. Can I go back to bed now? No one answered. They had just kept looking out into the dark and listening to the tone as if hypnotized. They had spent most of 14 years believing they might be the last people alive on Earth, and suddenly someone else was saying hello. Dalton walked away from the group, heading along the shore. A few seconds later, he turned towards the water and walked out along a wooden pier. "Where are you going?" Frank Evans asked. "Isn't it obvious?" Dalton thought as he bent down to untie one of the boats. "We need to think about this," Evans said. "What's to think about?" Dalton retorted. "Someone's shouting, 'Is there anybody out there?' and we need to answer." "You don't know that," Harris said. "How do you know one of the walkers wasn't just wandering around some factory somewhere, and the thing just happened to lean on a lever by accident, turning that siren on?" Dalton chuffed. "You think anything still works out there after 14 years? He pointed across the water. "Somebody set that noise up. Somebody alive." "All I'm saying is we shouldn't rush," Evans suggested. "We need to think this through, decide what's best." "We don't know how long that siren's going to last," Dalton said. "Could be 2 minutes or 2 weeks. If we don't find it before it stops, we never will." He jumped down into the boat. It was a small cruiser, about 5 meters long, with a cabin and an outboard motor. Harris's wife, Chloe, said, "But the river will only take you so far. Then you'll have to go on foot, across land." "Relax, love," Harris said. "We've all been on scavenging trips before." "Aye, by daylight. And Wilson got himself killed on one of them, if you remember." Harris started walking back towards the house. "Where are you going?" "To get changed. You don't think I'm heading down the river in these?" Harris pointed at his pajamas. "What? You're going?" "Be back before you know it." He turned away and ran into the house. Dalton topped the fuel tank. It gave off a hollow ring, empty. "How about it, Evans? Juice her up?" "Emergencies only," Evans replied. "You know that." "I think this qualifies, don't you?" Dalton said. Evans hesitated, then shifted his attention to Roger McKee. "Go get them a barrel. One barrel." By the time McKee returned, Harris was back, fully dressed, with a pistol stuffed down the back of his jeans. He lifted Sarah and gave her a big hug, followed by a kiss. "Harris, please," Chloe begged. "Don't make a scene, love. I'm going and that's that." Harris placed the child in his wife's arms, kissed Chloe goodbye, and jumped in the boat. After filling up the tank, Dalton pulled the ripcord and the engine roared into life. The mechanical purr drowned out the siren completely, but he had a general idea of the direction and that would be enough for now. "Good luck, man," Evans called as the boat surged forward into the dark. They headed south across Loch Ness and reached the shoreline within half an hour. Dalton switched off the engine and listened. "Definitely louder, I'd say, and still due south." "The question is," Harris said, "do we go on foot from here or do we detour west and use the river?" Although it was dark, they knew the mouth of the River Ban was near the southwest corner of the lake, and they knew the river wound its way southeast for many kilometres. It was their usual scavenging route, a safer method of raiding towns and villages than travelling across land, and it allowed them to venture much further from home than they would otherwise have dared. Harris switched on a flashlight and shone the beam inland. About 30 metres ahead, a road ran parallel to the water's edge, overgrown with tall weeds. Beyond that, an overturned car lay in a ditch in front of dense woodland. To the left, behind an out-of-control lawn, was a quaint cottage smothered in ivy. From somewhere close by came a groan. Harris swept the flashlight to the right, catching a brief glimpse of a figure standing on the road. He brought the beam back again, coming to rest on the source of the noise. The walker had once been a man in his 20s, judging by what was left of its appearance. Its face was still intact, except for one eye and whatever damage time and maggots had done in 14 years. It was wearing a pair of tattered denim jeans and a moldy t-shirt. Something glinted on its chest. A knife. So this guy had seen some action. In his mind's eye, Dalton imagined some poor fellow plunging the blade into this walker's heart, foolishly imagining that the strike would be enough to kill it. "You chose the wrong vital organ, pal," he thought. The walker groaned again, with a hint of anger. It raised its arms and staggered towards the light. Harris's beam wavered as he reached into the back of his jeans. Dalton gripped the other man's arm. "Save your ammo. We'll try the river. Might as well get as much use out of this boat as we can." He switched on the engine. The noise aggravated the walker. It reached the water's edge and staggered on, its ankles disappearing under the surface. But the boat cruised slowly west, leaving the creature's shambling form behind within a couple of minutes. They stopped the boat periodically, but by the time they had travelled 8 kilometres along the river, there was no longer any need for pause. The siren was audible above the rumble of the engine. The clouds on the eastern skyline were suffused with reds and purples from the first rays of the sun, exuding a beauty that was in stark contrast to the cursed landscape below. Occasionally, a lone walker would notice the boat and stagger through the weeds towards the edge of the river, moaning hungrily. Dalton and Harris never saw more than one creature at any given time. That was the advantage in travelling by water. There had never been much urban development along the river. Few people living there in the past meant a few dead people wandering there today. The next bend revealed a massive stone bridge with 3 arches spanning the river 200 metres ahead. In the dull morning light, the outlines of tall buildings could be seen on either side of the bridge. Some of them had signs hanging above their doors and windows. On the side of one building, the tattered remains of a 30-foot-wide billboard proclaimed, "Sky TV, only $14.99 per month." "What town is this?" Harris asked. "Portadown," Dalton answered, and switched off the engine for the last time. Harris didn't need to ask why. The river continued southeast, whereas the siren was coming from somewhere northeast of here. The change in direction had been so abrupt that the source had to be close by. "I'm guessing we've only got a couple of kilometres ahead of us," Harris said. "Let's hope so." To the left were several jetties housing 3 moss-infested boats, none of which were fully afloat. Beyond the jetties, behind a veil of long grass, lay the skeleton of an old boathouse, its walls having rotted away and its roof now lying on the floor. Dalton grabbed an oar and began to paddle. Within minutes, the boat was secured and the 2 men were standing on solid ground. "Hello," Harris called. "Anybody here?" Dalton chuffed and rolled his eyes. "What are you expecting, tea and biscuits?" "Well, if one of those things is lying down somewhere in all this grass..." "Aye, it might be taking a nap." "I'm just being careful. I don't want anything reaching out and biting me on the ankle." "Well then, what you should have said was, come on out, dinner is served!" Without waiting for a reply, Dalton stepped forward. The tall grass to the left of him rustled. Dalton felt something latch onto his boot. He lost his balance and fell forward onto his chest. Stiff, cold fingers grasped at his ankles, clawing up his legs. He twisted over onto his back, bringing the shotgun to bear, terror filling his mind to a degree he hadn't experienced in years. At the same time, Harris darted to Dalton's side and delivered a swift kick to the walker's abdomen, hard enough to dislodge its fingers and flip its body over and away from its prey. Dalton scrambled to his feet, panting. He got a proper look at his assailant for the first time. For once, the word walker didn't quite fit the bill. The creature's legs were missing. Nothing remained but 2 ugly stumps where cartilage and bone protruded. The lower half of its jaw was gone too, giving it a more gruesome appearance than most of its brethren. Unable to walk and unable to groan, it was unwittingly a creature of stealth. "You should be more careful," Harris said. "Point taken." Dalton brought his boot down on the walker's chest, pinning it to the ground. Its hands grasped at the man's trousers. Look at it. Doesn't have the sense to know it can't even take a bite with a mouth like that. Harris pulled the pistol from the back of his jeans. Shall I? But Dalton was already unsheathing a large hunting knife from around his waist. With his boot still planted firmly on the walker's chest, he leaned forward and grasped a handful of its hair. Holding the head still, he used his other hand to bring the blade down slowly, first piercing the eye and then sliding it into the brain. The creature's fingers went limp and fell to the ground, never to rise again. Beyond the boathouse was a rickety old wooden gate wide enough for a car, with barbed wire along the top. The gate was lying open and a rusty chain hung loose. I remember this place, Dalton said. It was about 10 years ago. There should be a car park through there and a big store. The place where I got Kate her fancy electric heater. The car park was about 100 meters square, located in a secluded spot surrounded by tall buildings. There was nothing parked here now but weeds and litter. At the far end, above panes of broken glass, which Dalton remembered breaking, was a sign saying, Portadown Fireplaces. To the right of this, a thin road provided the only exit to the area. What's through there? Harris asked, pointing. Downtown, I guess. I thought you'd been here before. Right here, yes. I didn't go any further. Town centres are too risky. So come on. Storefronts lined both sides of the road. Gary's Bar, Poots Funeral Directors, The Frying Saucer, Ross Raymond's Cycles. Across the bridge, the rest of the town centre lay in a desolate sprawl. There was not a single walker in sight. Dalton stood in the middle of the street, stunned. This was something he had never seen before. In all his experience of scavenging, every downtown area he had encountered had always been teeming with undead life. The opportunity of raiding all these unguarded shops made him tremble with excitement. But he was here on more pressing business. And the nagging question remained, if the dead were not downtown? Where are they? Harris asked. Dalton turned away from the town centre to face the direction of the siren. He began to worry about what lay ahead. The sound led Dalton and Harris uphill along Carrickblacker Avenue, where the shops ended and the suburbs began. Again, the place was deserted. They walked on the centre of the road, since many of the footpaths were now overgrown with garden trees and hedges gone wild. Passing the spire of Edenderry Methodist Church, Harris stopped and took a penknife from his pocket. He cut a strip of material from his sleeve, then sliced it into four smaller pieces, two of which he handed to Dalton. Dalton didn't need to ask what they were intended for. He immediately pushed the material into his ears, while Harris did likewise. The siren's whine was mercifully dulled. Dalton and Harris knew they had reached Journey's End when they heard a new sound. Even above the wheel of the siren, even with their ears stuffed up, they could hear the moans and growls of the walkers all rolled into a single mass of noise. On Kilcomain Road, at the crest of the hill, the two men stood facing the open gates of an expansive set of buildings labelled Portadown College. The driveway curved around the side of the main building to a car park, after which the land appeared to fall away. Although the sun was now peering over the horizon, illuminating everything, the men had no way of seeing what was beyond the building from this angle. Dalton stepped forward. Harris grabbed his arm. This is madness, he said, raising his voice over the noise. That racket's coming from way over there, Dalton said, pointing in the direction of the car park. My guess is the building's empty. If we can get onto the roof... Harris shook his head. This isn't what we expected. Let's just go. Do what you like, Dalton said, but after coming this far, I'm not about to bail out just because I'm nervous. He shrugged out of Harris's grip and strode on. After a moment's consideration, the other man followed. The entrance doors were shattered, providing easy access. Dalton stepped into the foyer, his boots crunching on pieces of glass. One glance to the left revealed an assembly hall littered with dusty old blankets and sleeping bags. Clearly, the building had been used as a rescue station back when the world started going to hell. And like all of those stations, things had gone bad quickly. Small islands were the only places of safety, the smaller the better. Dalton and Harris headed along a corridor, the noise of the walkers diminishing. They found a flight of stairs and kept on it until they were at the top, two floors up. Here, classrooms lined both sides of the corridor. Some doors were open, others closed. The walls were decorated with photographs of students in black and cyan uniforms, all of whom you could say with reasonable certainty were long dead. The air up here was stale. Dalton kept his shotgun in front of him at all times. Having his ears plugged meant he probably wouldn't hear a walker creeping up on him, even if it were moaning. After a few minutes of searching, the two men located a thin stairway leading up to a closed door with a padlock. Dalton aimed his shotgun and fired. The padlock and a sizable portion of the door disappeared. Pale sunlight streamed through the hole. Dalton stepped up and pushed the door open. He walked out onto a flat roof, the collective moans of the dead assaulting his ears again. As the men walked slowly across the gravel surface, the edge of the roof receded to the bottom of their field of vision, like a theatre curtain pulling back to reveal a scene. And what a scene! Dalton and Harris were looking at what was once a rugby field, although there was practically no grass in sight to give you that information. You could tell it was a rugby field only by the faded white goalposts reaching up into the sky. The grass was hidden behind a surging mass of walkers. There had to be at least 2,000 of them. They stood shoulder to shoulder, like fans at a rock concert. There was a distinct circular pattern to their arrangement, with all of them facing one set of goalposts. Their faces were tilted up, and some of them reached skyward with their arms, as if in passionate prayer. Dalton's eyes travelled up the goalpost. He spotted something bright and red attached to it near the top. When he squinted, the object focused into the shape of two cones back to back. Loudspeakers. Fastened below these was a black box, presumably a battery. "Do you see that?" Harris asked. "I should have known this would happen," Dalton said. There was no magic, and not much science either, in a pack of walkers surrounding a siren. Dalton had fired enough bullets in his life to know that when you shot one walker, the sound of your gun usually brought several more of them heading your way. The dumb creatures would follow anything remotely interesting. "And he should have known," Dalton continued. "Who?" "Whoever set that beacon up. This is one hell of a hello." "Well, what else could he have done? Besides, we answered, didn't we?" Dalton nodded. "Where is he now, I wonder," Harris said. "Probably ran off when the mob showed up." "What do we do?" Dalton sat down on the gravel and let his legs dangle over the edge of the building. "We wait." Tony Ellis was the only person in Firethorn who owned a helicopter. This gave him certain responsibilities that no one else had to endure, dangerous ones at that, but it was worth it. During a flight home from a raid to the mainland, he would look out of the cockpit at the bleak country below, decaying buildings, vegetation spreading everywhere as nature tried to bury the corpse of the old world. And then there were the dead, nothing but tiny specks from up here, wandering aimlessly around. They had defeated an entire world, and now they had nothing to do but walk. They wouldn't just die, oh no, that would have been too simple. It was easy to get depressed looking at all that. Easy to dwell upon life as it had been before, and to remember loved ones who had perished. But nothing could compare to the joy he would feel after reaching the coastline and crossing those last 5 kilometres of sea. Then he would be flying over a patchwork quilt of fields where all kinds of crops grew and cattle grazed. On the roads, he would see men and women going about their business on bicycles and horses. In urban areas, children ran about safely outdoors, playing games. This was the island of Firethorn, located just off the east coast of a country that used to be called Ireland. This was home. This morning, however, Ellis was not on his way back to Farthorn, he was heading out. And today's mission was not a raid, it was something new. The helicopter hovered 100 metres above the rugby field. Ellis gazed down in amazement at the crowd below. In all his missions, he had never seen so many returners crammed into such a small space. His high vantage point allowed him to observe the nearby streets, deserted. Possibly every returner in the whole town, at least every returner within reasonable earshot of the siren, had showed up. Farthorn's current population was 675 souls and growing steadily. In the years to come, space was going to get tight and resources tighter. Several times the men had attempted to expand onto the Irish shoreline, but they kept being pushed back out to the island. There were just too many returners, and for every one you killed, another would wander in from elsewhere to take its place, usually more than one. Ireland, and the rest of the world, belonged to the dead. But not for very much longer. When Ellis finished up here today, he didn't think the mayor would hesitate to authorize another mission like this one, and another, until mankind got back what once belonged to him. Ellis touched the controls, giving the chopper more altitude and positioning it directly over the center of the gathering. On the panel in front of him was a newly fitted switch. It was red, surrounded by a clear plastic cover which had been fitted as a contingency against flicking the switch by accident. Underneath, a label marked Deploy had been taped on. Ellis removed the cover and positioned his finger over the switch. Taking one last look out of the cockpit, he caught sight of two returners on the roof of the nearby college. It didn't matter. The building was well within the projected blast radius. It almost looks like they're waving, Ellis thought with a smile, and flicked the switch. A rectangular package fell from the bottom of the helicopter. Kilometers away, on a tiny island populated by two men, two women, and three children, everyone stopped what they were doing and gazed south as a sound like thunder rolled across the lake.